today on Against the Grain. In what ways is society becoming militarized? What role does race play in this process of militarization? And what does David Theo Goldberg mean when he says that race is the secularization of the religious? I'm C.S. Song. The prominent race theorist and University of California Irvine professor joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. There is a logic at work in many places, including the U.S., a logic of militarization that seeps into, that infects so many aspects of our everyday lives, that it often goes unnoticed. It's often taken as a kind of common sense. David Theo Goldberg is interested in this process of militarization, what it is, how it operates, and who or what gets victimized or marginalized in the process. Goldberg, a professor of comparative literature and anthropology at UC Irvine and the author of many books, is also interested in the role race plays in militarizing societies, how race is perceived and deployed by regimes to advance certain interests over others, to target certain populations, and safeguard others. In a recent article called Militarizing Race, David Theo Goldberg also asserts that race is the secularization of the religious, that today's anti-Muslim fervor is not primarily religion-focused, and that many groups working to demilitarize society may be reproducing notions and methods of the very militarizing tendencies they oppose. David Theo Goldberg directs the University of California Humanities Research Institute, and he's the author and editor of many books, including Are We All Post-Racial Yet? And Sites of Race. When David joined me recently in studio to discuss his article about militarization, race, and religion, which appeared in the journal Social Text, I asked him whether by militarization he meant only or primarily the inclination to go to war. And I should say that he mentions the names of the French theorist Michel Foucault and the Prussian thinker Karl von Clausewitz.
So that's a fairly complicated question, of course. By militarizing, I want to begin by the way in which a society cedes to itself a set of conditions in which it fashions both a way of thinking, a development of technology, and the implication of that into the very fabric of the society itself, so that both the way of thinking, the way of organizing itself, the way of policing itself both internally and externally, the forms of schooling, the forms of socialization, the forms of sociality are all informed by, though not in any reductive sense necessarily simply determined by, what I'm calling this logic of militarization. That disposes a society to go to war without requiring it or demanding it or necessitating that it should go to war in any particular circumstance. Its disposition, when challenged both within and challenged from externally, especially externally, but increasingly internally too, its disposition is to act in ways violently where war, as we commonly understand it, that is the declaration of an enemy, the definition of responding to that enemy in terms of weaponry, killing, taking prisoners of war, perhaps. So it creates a sensibility where its state and status in the world is defined in terms of its disposition to aggressiveness. And that aggressiveness might spill over into actual war or not. Now, in a broader sense of the notion of war, you can say that it's always at war, a militarized society. And by that, what one means, sort of following somebody like Foucault and maybe even Clausewitz, although in different modalities, there's a sense in which all the local struggles within the society, the struggle over ownership, the struggle over who gets to control land and resources, the struggle over who gets to pocket the wealth, the struggle over who gets put to work, the struggle over how people are treated. I mean, all those, what one otherwise would think as, you know, the social conditions of everyday life in societies that are defined both hierarchically and in terms of owners and those who don't own, in those who are wealthier and those who are not, the disposition to keep one's wealth at the expense of others, and so on. All those struggles, you could say, are a form of war. It's a form of undertaking to push and shove and force and make people act in a way they might on their own not otherwise choose to act. And in that broader sense of war-making, you can say that all social struggles, all social conflicts in that kind of way are defined in terms of this this condition of extended war-making, where, you know, where Clausewitz says that war is politics by other means, Foucault sort of turns it on its head and said, politics is war by other means, right? So the normal condition under the Foucauldian conception is war, and politics is just an extension of war. So it's in a way turning Clausewitz on his head.
What are some, let's talk about some manifestations of this militarizing logic in everyday life, in social life. So what are, for example, some cultural products in which we can see the logic of militarization at work?
There are a range of things. I mean, we can start with the contemporary and maybe work ourselves back. But think of the way in which battle fatigues have become, in a sense, high fashion, let alone everyday fashion. People wear caps, they wear T-shirts, they wear trousers that are sometimes high-end. You see models walking the catwalk in what effectively are designer fashion battle fatigues, right? But that, in a way, you can say, well, that's trivial. You know, what's the matter with that? But it disposes those in the society to think that not only is that fashionable, but one is at ease with what that conveys. There's an openness, there's an at-easeness, there's a comfort level with seeing oneself in a society where what I'm characterizing as militarization is just part of the everyday fabric of the culture, a kind of common sense that becomes uncontested, which is, you know, different than saying that one honors one's soldiers when they go to war in one's behalf in order to protect one's freedom and so on. This is a way in which the very culture itself, the thinking and the acting, the aggressiveness that one's seeing increasingly on planes, for example, are fueled by this at-easeness, this comfortability with the dispositions of aggression as the common condition of everyday life, right? Instead of working things out by arguing a bit and then coming to the table and mediating the differences that one has, one moves very quickly to an aggressive response, pushing and shoving and kicking and hitting and pulling out a gun and walking around with open carry guns and so on and so on and so on, right? So that you can begin to see the relation between an expression on the one hand, a cultural expression on the one hand, and action that has real material effects in terms of how people interact with each other, respond to each other, the lack of patience, the aggressiveness that's in place and the like. And you can think of other examples of this kind. I mean, there's a sense in which much, I won't say all, but not far from all the high-end technology that we have come to use, certainly since the Second World War and probably a lot earlier, that high-end technology is created through R&D that at least is funded by, if not straightforwardly under the control of the military, right? So you think of motorbikes, motor cars to some degree, Second World War, especially the technologization of motor cars, that the next generation of motor cars after the Model T and things like that. You know, obviously guns, aircraft, GPS today, computers, you can go on and on and on in this kind of way. Boots, backpacks, and so on and so forth. So the way in which we bring into our, not just our daily lives, but our work lives, our communicative lives, and so on, the technologies that we do owe to military R&D sort of shows the way in which this this way of being in the world seeps into our very being without our even thinking or about it or realizing it. And that then has further implications. We want more of it. We want the next generation of high-end technology. And so we're going to fuel the resources to operate in that way. But that's, you're not just fueling the R&D, you're also fueling the industry that translates into maintaining not just the technological development, but the way of thinking and way of being in the world that necessarily goes along with it.
David Theo Goldberg is his name. He's professor of comparative literature and anthropology at the University of California, Irvine, and he directs the University of California Humanities Research Institute. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You also refer in this article that we're kind of addressing this hour in the journal Social Text, you refer to national anthems and parades and Memorial Day holidays.
Yes, indeed. So when one thinks about national anthems and you go and look at the lyrics, right, rockets are blaring or whatever the exact words are off the top of my head. The home of the land of the free and the home of the brave is a reference to the set of dispositions that I'm pointing to. But it's obviously not just the United States. You look at the anthem in France, you look which refers to explicitly to blood, God Save the Queen, the anthem of the apartheid government under South Africa, which has been maintained in the post-apartheid moment, has fairly aggressive language attendant to it. So you can pretty much go down the list of nation states, and you will find, if not all, to a larger rather than lesser degree, the way in which the sort of language of both self-protection and aggression gets sewn together in the maintenance of the boundedness of the nation state, almost necessarily. You think of parades, the opening of parliament, Buckingham Palace, the ways in which you have flyovers over major sports events, the fact that one is singing the national anthem, at pretty much every sports event, and in schools in the morning, right, just reiterates and repeats so that it becomes, again, second nature. And one almost doesn't think about the aggressivity in the language itself, right? So you can see the way in which the nation state is structured around the set of, the modern nation state is structured around the set of conceptions, dispositions, the shaping of the way people think about these things, uniforms. Uniforms get taken over and form the police. So the police have uniforms. Many, many professional jobs have uniforms. Schools, a little less so in the United States, unless it's a private school that requires a uniform. But I grew up in South Africa where, to go to school, you had to get dressed in a uniform with a jacket and a tie and a white shirt and flannel gray trousers and, black shoes and so on and so forth, right? But that notion of uniform, of creating a commonality that is also then not just common to people, but putting people in line, of lining up. Even the production line becomes an extension of a kind of military form of production, right? That people are standing in line. They're obeying the order to do a particular job repetitively over and over and over again.
Yeah, work life, you refer in this article to the clocked workday, to training, to hierarchies in employment and elsewhere. Your piece in the journal Social Text, it appeared in the December 2016 issue, it is entitled Militarizing Race. So you bring race in, and you are a race theorist, among other things. So maybe one way we could get into this relationship that you see between militarization and race is to examine the term, the notion, martial race, M-A-R-T-I-A-L, race. And you know, this notion of martial races informs how you view race in relationship to processes of militarization. So first of all, what is a martial race?
Yeah, so a martial race emerges as a notion, as a concept, under late-ish British colonialism. It's really formulated in the context of the British colonization of India in the 1920s and 1930s by the person commanding the British forces, commander of the forces, General McMahon, Commander McMahon, who writes a book called Martial Races in 1933, yes? And in doing so, he's thinking of the way in which, in his terms, martiality is natural to certain kinds, races of people. I mean, he's explicit about the use of the word race. And there might be other races for whom it's not a natural condition, but you know, some of the qualities are there that would dispose them to being trained to becoming martial or martial-like. And then there are those who don't have it at all. So what does he have in mind? So he says quite explicitly that the people of Western Europe, and he names, I mean, he doesn't call it Western Europe at the time, that notion sort of emerges a bit later, but he names the states that are the states of Western Europe, like France and Germany and the Netherlands and of course Britain, because he represents them and so on, that as a matter of course, they are born with the qualities that make them martial, the qualities of courage, the qualities of physical ability. Now, in the context of India, there's been a long-standing kind of characterization of Hindus, for example, not as martial races, but more like effeminate, right? So the larger proportions of the population of India, in his view, would be effeminate, that is exactly the antithesis of a martial race. But there are, he said, certain folks, certain classes of people, certain races or sub-races of people, if one wants to put it in those terms, such as Sikhs and Gurkhas, who have the capacity or the disposition to be trained by the British into not only being able to fight on behalf of the British in the fights that they're conducting or thinking that they might have to conduct, both in the region and beyond, so creating battalions out of Sikhs and Gurkhas, but also who have the disposition to develop the kind of judgment that would be effective in those kinds of circumstances. And so this notion of martial races develops, in a sense, out of this conception. And I wanted to extend it to indicate that there's a way in which the racial characterization, the racial formation, the racial production of martiality brings together this notion of raciality and martiality into a kind of self-defining that then disposes this aggressivity to the world, but also a self-ascribed capacity to rule the world at the same time. I mean, I'm reading this into the way in which a society or a range of societies conceive of itself, coming out of, you know, the post 18th century, really, sort of self-conception of modernity, in which race defines the modern state formation. Those who see themselves as having the capacity to develop, shape, lead both the nation state and the commonwealth of nation states over others who are taken not to have that capacity at all.
In other words, people of color are seen as subordinate, as opposed to people who are white are seen as the people who ought to rule.
Right. Those who are European or of European descent, right, ascribe to themselves the capacity to rule over those who are not, right, where those who are not are, you know, the wide range of people of color.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. David Theo Goldberg is my guest. He's a professor of comparative literature and anthropology at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author and editor of many books on racism and race, including most recently, Are We All Post-Racial Yet? And Sites of Race. And he wrote an article entitled Militarizing Race for the journal Social Text. So how much does race play a role in a militarizing society's determination of who belongs and who doesn't? And I'm thinking, for example, of, you know, the assaults on and all the rhetoric against Muslims in this country, which suggests a religious category. And you actually do bring up religion as well as race in this piece, in Social Text. So if we stick with race for just a moment, how important is race and racial categories to a militarizing society like the U.S. Determining who's the enemy, whether it be within or without, and who is really part of the main fabric of society who needs to be defended?
In my understanding of the history of race and state making, the way I put it pithily, there's a much longer argument here, but the way I put it pithily is that modern states become modern by taking up, in not always in the same way, obviously, but in overlapping and common ways, taking up the organizing principles of race. And the organizing principles of race to define who's in charge, who's in control, who's elevated, and who's not in the society, who has access, who has privilege, who's excluded, who has ownership, who has control, who rules, and who's ruled over. You know, the argument is that you can look at any society in its being brought into the fold of modernity, and the language of race creeps in at one point or another. It's obvious for societies that were colonized, there the technology of race itself is explicit, invariably. But it's there to increasingly explicitly from the 18th century onwards, internally in European societies. So, you know, up until about the middle of the 18th century, for European societies, while race was implicitly there internally, explicitly it was there always in relation to the elsewhere, the colonies, the outside. You know, the wars that were taking place within Europe at the time were religious wars until the mid-18th century. And it's really from the middle of the 18th century, the emergence of the Enlightenment, after all, right, that the language of race becomes more explicated within the boundaries of Europe itself for a number of different reasons. So there's a sense in which the technologies of race get taken up by modern societies to define who belongs and who does not, who has full belonging and who is at best partial belonging. You know, at a moment that modern societies, as they become modern, are becoming increasingly heterogeneous, right? The fact that there were colonies means that the traffic was not only one way from the colonizer to the colonized. People returned, they brought back ideas, they brought back slaves, people traveled. You know, in London by 1800, 1 to 2% of the population of London was of African descent, right? That's 10 to 20,000 people in a city of 1 million people. So there was a visible presence in that sense. And race then, immediately that heterogeneity shows up in the society, race becomes explicated, right? It becomes absolutely explicit. And so race is taken up precisely in order to define who belongs or belongs fully and who does not. And it becomes the means by which both identification takes place, you know, to which race, to which population group do you belong? So it becomes at exactly the time also that census taking, that is racially explicit, kicks into place. In the United States, the first census of 1790, that is national, right, is defined in terms of a number of categories, including racial categories, right? Men, women, white, Negro, to use that term, they used, and American Indian, right, Native American. So, three of the five categories that were counted were in this extended sense racial categories. Precisely in order, I mean, census taking gave you a picture of the population. So it was in order to count who's there and who's not. But that count was also to be able to establish lines of control in relation to who properly belonged and who didn't, who could access certain kinds of work and who would be delimited to menial labor, who would be the wealth producers and who would be the wealth takers, and so on and so forth. And so race becomes a crucial form that then factors into the way in which militarization factors itself out, because in order to maintain those lines of racial division and control, it required a form of aggressivity. You step out of line, we're going to whack you over the head. We're going to put you in jail. We're going to shoot you. We're going to subject you to penal conditions and so on and so forth. So the society takes up race in order to define the lines of division within the society, and then also to be reinforced by the forms of militarization that maintain those divisions and that hierarchy.
Let's talk about religion and the theological, which I said you bring up also in this article in Social Text. You write that militarization and the theological are sewn together. How?
Yes. So, I mean, we've seen the ways in which militarization, already we've spoken about the ways in which military forms of culture then get taken up in the broader society that conceives of itself as not necessarily, in a professional sense, the military, but infuse the daily lives through parades or through, you know, other forms of social definition and so forth, practice and the like. Teamwork, the way in which, you know, even in Wall Street today, the sense in which the control room in financial operations where trades are being made is called the war room or the operation room or the turret, right? So you can see the way in which, I mean, the high end of corporate life in society is driven by the very language, strategy and tactics, the kind of winning and losing, the ways in which the very conception that emerges out of the military then infuses broad understandings of the society and operation. So the theological provides one with a way, if one thinks back into sort of what a religious conception and self-conception offer, it offers a narrative of origins, of where we come from and how we come to be who we are. It offers a sense of kinship, of who belonged to each other and how that belonging came about. It offers a sense of community in that sense, the belonging, the encouragement to treat others who are like one in certain sorts of ways, and those who are not like one to dismiss or treat in ways that are less convivial or less generous. And so you can see in a variety of these registers how militarization and the theological come together. For one, historically, there's a sense in which armies were either in service of or responding to religious conception. Crusades in behalf of the driving religion, whether it was straightforwardly the church or not. The way in which then, as the military historically emerges out of that understanding, the way in which in the military itself, it takes on and keeps certain vestiges of that kind of religious self-understanding. And I don't just mean saying prayers in the morning, I have a quite marvelous little story from having served very briefly in the army in South Africa when I was an 18-year-old, which I'll come back to in a moment. But the way in which medals, right, reflect religious emblems, the Iron Cross being the most obvious, right, or the way in which greetings get socialized into the daily life of military practice and so on and so forth. The story I was going to refer to was, so while in the army, there was a drought in the part of South Africa. There'd been no rain for like 3 months or 6 months. And so the commanders of the military called one morning that the whole camp come onto the parade ground in order to pray for rain. You know, being a skeptic about such things, right, I sort of wondered how this was going to play out. But as we all fell out onto the parade ground, these dark clouds started sort of gathering overhead, and I thought, oh, maybe the Afrikaners really do have a direct line to God over here, right? The prayers were said, and, you know, an hour later, everybody was dismissed, and as everybody dismissed, even though they'd been rumbling in the clouds started breaking up, and there wasn't rain for another 6 months, right? But you can see the way in which, you know, in that particular context, the theological, you know, God will guide us, not just in bringing rain, but in bringing victory to ourselves. So those dispositions sort of then come together. But there's also, as I argue in the piece, the way in which historically the theological gives way to the racial, and the racial takes up the very logic of the theological in providing the origin story, in providing kinship relations, a sense of community. You know, so that I characterize this as the racial being a secularization of the religious, the way in which, you know, what we identify as religious self-understanding and so on sort of falls explicitly by the wayside, but both the dispositions and the forms of action get taken up in the name of the racial as a kind of secularized version of what had been provided by the theological.
Can you be a little more specific about that? Because this is very interesting, this notion that race is the secularization of the religious.
So yeah, the way in which this plays out is during the period of the medieval, the religious, the church, both the institution of the religious and the sense of socialization and way of being in the world was theologically driven. I don't mean to say that this suddenly came to an end, of course, in the, you know, say 1500, but as one begins to get the emergence of explicit forms of race thinking, first as kinship or emerging out of kinship, then lineage, then type, and into species and subspecies over a 200 to 300 year period, you had the racial looming larger and larger. I mean, in that shift, first from being the externality of Europe, the outside of Europe, and then, you know, from the middle of the 18th century onwards, increasingly brought into the self-definition of Europe internally as well. And so you see the shift taking place as religious self-conception, you know, in the Reformation, even arguably under the Counter-Reformation, but emerging out of that fight between what today one would characterize as the Roman Catholic on the one hand and the emergence of the Protestant on the other, is the shift to the religious becoming an individualized, private self-definition, right? So that the religious becomes a form of self-choice, where hitherto it had not been that at all. And what emerges at the level of the social in order to fill that kind of vacuum that's left at the register of the definition of the communal, of the broadly social, is the racial rushing in to provide definition of that. And the racial doesn't assume the explicit language of the religious, but it takes on the very work that the religious had been doing And it puts it into its, the racial puts it into its own terms. So what do I mean by that? If you take the notion of origins, where do we come from? Well, we all come from a, you know, under the religious, the self-understanding would, you know, we're born one under God, and then a certain moment, a subgroup emerges to define itself in a given part of the world with a set of characteristics and a way of thinking, a relation to pre-life and afterlife, and so on and so forth. Well, the racial begins to take that over and provide a different language of articulation for that. But it's still providing a story of origins. It's still providing a story about kinship. It's still providing a narrative of community and who belongs to the community and who doesn't in the way in which the religious had previously done.
His name is David Theo Goldberg. He's professor of comparative literature and anthropology at UC Irvine, and he directs the University of California Humanities Research Institute. And he's, again, the author and editor of many books on racism and race theory. And he wrote an article for the journal Social Text, its December 2016 issue that we're discussing today. It's called Militarizing Race. So, David, what about the anti-Muslim fervor today and in recent years? Is that, in your view, primarily religion-focused?
I want to say that it's not just religiously focused. If it were just religiously focused, there'd be, you know, theological debates. There'd be, you know, an understanding of different ways of seeing the world and so on and so forth, right? I mean, all of that, of course, is there. But it's, you know, Muslims are largely defined in terms of how the aggressor thinks they ought to look, and then defined in terms of their place relation in the world, right? Their geographic location, where they emanate from, right? What their lineage is, what their kinship structure is. And so that becomes immediately racially conceived, right? And so, you know, the stories that we're getting on almost a daily basis of people boarding a plane and then shouting at people with brown skin, you don't belong here, go back to where you come from. You know, there might be a presumption of where you come from. You know, there's that funny story of a woman of color in London being shouted at one point, you know, maybe half a decade or so ago, where some horrible white person in the street says, "Go back to where you come from." And she says, "Well, if you would give me cab money, I'd happily get in a cab and go to the next suburb over where I really come from," right? But you can see the way in which there's a kind of self-understanding and a set of presumptions, a presumptuousness that's tied to color, that's tied to dress, that's tied to perceived culture or cultural difference, that's tied to color and its relation to culture. You know, you might say body and its relation to behavior. And those stereotypically defined sort of conceptions and self-conceptions are then drawn on so that it's not just a religious understanding. It's religion and race kind of mutually seeping into each other and becoming more or less indistinguishable. And, you know, one sees it played out in different ways in different parts of the world. So just to give an example of how this becomes so presumptuous, when people who are prone to discriminate in exactly these sorts of ways are asked who they think of when they immediately think of Muslims, it's like most likely to be people from the Middle East, right? It's not likely, you know, maybe it's from Pakistan, right? Maybe it's from Afghanistan. Maybe it's, you know, but more likely to be Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and North Africa and so on and so forth, right? It's almost never from Indonesia. And it's certainly not from, you know, the neighbor next door, right? And unless it's characterized in a particular kind of way where those lines are already drawn, yeah? And so this sort of understanding where the lines are already taken to be drawn so that, you know, those who are presumed to be here and those presumed not to come from here are already written into the social script that then just gets reified in terms of the hard lines that are being defined to define people in and out. These things are today a deeply inscribed way in which religion is being knotted together with race.
If we get back to the militarization of society, and we look at perhaps, you know, one of the most vivid manifestations of that, which is societies going to war in the way that they do. What kinds of wars, in terms of, you know, resource consumption, energy consumption, how big can the wars be these days in order to serve the interests of elite, to serve the interests of capital, to serve the interests of the neoliberal regime?
There are a number of things to be said here as well. I mean, the first is that there's been a longish history, certainly a 20th century history, maybe starting with the First World War, but maybe you could trace it back to the Civil War, interestingly enough. And you can ask whether today we're back in incipiently drawing the lines of a civil war, which doesn't necessarily first and foremost resort to arms, right? Civil wars are not simply about arms. They're about different ways of seeing and being in the world. And those divisions are very starkly drawn in the society we're currently inhabiting, right? And so, you know, maybe we're in America's third civil war. If the civil, you know, that civil war, as it's called in the 19th century, was the first, and the second was the civil rights struggle. Maybe we're exactly in that moment. So that's a way of saying that, you know, wars can be small and social, but have great effect. So you think of the way in which warring and its dispositions orders our social self-conception. So, you know, just about every social struggle then became a war on crime, a war on poverty, a war on drugs, a war on prostitutes, a war on bad dudes, a war on immigrants, a war on Muslims, a war on you name it, right? So everything that became a tension around differences, difference in ways of thinking, differences in ways of behaving and acting, differences in ways of thinking about who we are and who we should be, those struggles become infused with the language of war, if not seen as actual wars themselves, right? And once you think in those terms, then, you know, the wars that are engaged in order to extend not just the forms of sociality, but also the self-understood well-being of the society, its mode of production, its capacity to flourish, its capacity to draw on the resources of others, the capacity to control labor flows, the capacity to control financial flows, the capacity to control what happens when capital lands on the ground in a particular place, to protect investments, to protect national interests. And all of those things become bid up as larger and larger forms of, you know, peacemaking is then an extension of war-keeping, if you want to mix your metaphors over here, right? So the two are deeply, deeply sewn together in this conception of social militarization, so that there's a necessity that the wars not be too large, because as soon as they're too large, they undercut, right, the very well-being of the society in play. They're draining. They're draining on human capital, they're draining on financial capital, they're draining on, you know, the natural capital of the society, right, its resources and so on and so forth. And so if one needs for a kind of military industrial slash academic complex, but certainly a military industrial complex, the wars have to be ongoing but low level, so that, you know, the population almost doesn't pay attention to them, right? They're just kind of humming in the background. And in a sense, that's, you know, that's been happening for at least the last 50 years. There's been, you know, war of one kind or another, not just at the what I characterized a moment ago as kind of social struggles, but actual war making. Troops being involved in battles of small or larger, skirmishes of small or larger kinds in, you know, various parts of the world and within the homeland as well. And so for a society that's driven by militarization, it's imperative both to maintain the levels of investment, both political, social, and economic, to maintain the conditions of possibility of successive states of that war-making and that economic form of being. But it's also required not to get too big to get out of hand, so it becomes exactly draining.
David Theo Goldberg joins me in studio. He's a prominent race theorist, the author of many books, and a professor at the University of California, Irvine. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So we have, on the one hand, one could say the forces toward militarization of the society, toward further militarization of the society, and then we have those forces, those parts of society that want to demilitarize society, and, you know, we would include social movements or some of them in that category. And you make an interesting argument in this piece about whether, in fact, these social movements, these opponents of militarization, incorporate certain militarizing characteristics and notions and ideas within them. So I wondered if you could talk about that and also talk about what the implications for that is.
Yes. So what I've been arguing is that, in part, there's a way of thinking that I'm ascribing to this notion of social militarization, wherever it might occur, not just in the society, right? And I've tried to spell out in bits and pieces sort of what aspects of those forms of thinking are. And those forms of thinking include, as I made reference along the way, notions of tactics, notions of strategy, a kind of teleology, a weaponizing in relation to effecting certain ends, the way in which ends are defined and maximized. Those forms of winning the battle or winning the war against others in a corporate kind of engagement and the like. And so when we think about struggles against militarization, of what I characterize at the end of the piece as an undertaking to think what demilitarizing the society might begin to look like, somewhat alongside thinking about colonization and decolonization, right? So, you know, what would it undertake to undo, to stop one's mode of thinking in these terms? So I think one has to give in, you know, as one is engaging in these forms of struggle, in these forms of undertaking to define the society otherwise than in these terms. You know, we all too often think about, you know, using notions of tactics or strategy, of using the kind of operational language, of having a military-like operation that will run like clockwork. I mean, at one end, you have the current president of the United States who said his administration is running like a military machine, right? Well, if that's how a military machine runs, well, already double woe to everybody. But on the other hand, you have struggles against that, sort of saying we have to be as well organized, as well-oiled a machine as that in order to face up to it. And what I think is a challenge is to ask ourselves, are there other ways of thinking unpredictably about what those struggles would look like? Because that, you know, that way of thinking is utterly predictable. It puts you into a mode of responding of the very kind that one is antithetical to. So you're trying to bring about a transformation or an undoing of the very thing by using its own, you know, the master's tools against itself, so to speak, And what I'm trying to get to is, are there creative, not predictable ways that those modes of thinking restrict us from even seeing, where the forms of response, the forms of undertaking, activity, intervention, are both unpredictable and make in the mode of intervention itself, get people to think differently about the very positions they're in, so they start acting differently. They start making different choices. And they make those choices for themselves precisely because they're thinking in different terms than the ordered terms of the day, than the terms of order that one is being given and reproducing in the very undertaking to undo them. So, that's the challenge I want to end with. I don't have a straightforward answer, but it's a way of thinking. There's a sort of cliche of thinking out of the box. That would be thinking out of the box.
Right, and it's precisely the predictability of the regime that in some ways makes it vulnerable to subversion or assault. And so, the predictability of movements in response could make, obviously, them very vulnerable in relation to the regime.
Yes, that's exactly right. And there's small and larger ways in which to do this. If you think of interventions, struggles on campus to maintain free speech in the wake of its closing down. The first mode is to go out and have a rally, right? And it's, the police then gather around, make sure that it's boxed in. It's not unimportant. It's a form of communication and of community making itself. So I don't want to belittle it. It has an important role. But it also stops one from thinking, they know we're going to do this because we do it every time, right? Are there other ways in which to stop them short in their tracks and say, hey, what are they saying to us? We hadn't thought in this way, and all of a sudden they're stopping us in our tracks and saying, well, maybe we should convey the message that we want to convey to those inhabiting, in this case, a university space, to get those who are exactly comfortable, right, in their mode, not to react by saying, oh, there they go again, but to say, hey, they have a point. Let me think along with them and think otherwise than I've been thinking in these ways.
David Theo Goldberg, professor of comparative literature and anthropology at UC Irvine, author and editor of books, many books, most recently, Are We All Post-Racial Yet? And Sites of Race. And we have a link to his faculty page at UC Irvine, as well as to at least one of his books, as well as to his article in the journal Social Text called Militarizing Race. David, great seeing you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure, as always.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.